anti-internet businesses are those that cannot be done over the internet, such as preparing food, cutting hair, or making steel, and those that are in some ways a reaction against the internet. This would include things like shopping centers and Starbucks coffee houses. Starbucks and the shopping center are anti-internet businesses because they benefit from the fact that the more people are home alone with their computers surfing the net, the more these same people will want to get out of the house, go to the mall, or Starbucks, or Main Street, and touch someone, smell something, taste something, or feel something. Products will always need exposure in a way that people can touch or feel. People will always seek community, whether on Main Street or in the mall. As the internet becomes the backbone of global commerce, education, and communication, the quality and scope of the networking within countries will be decisive in determining their economic strength. So, who's hot and who's not today, according to this new networking power standard? Taiwan is feared in Silicon Valley for its innovative prowess, connectivity, and dynamic capitalist business culture that deftly exploits all this technology. If Taiwan were a stock, I'd buy it. The United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, Scandinavia, Iceland, Israel, Italy, Singapore, Costa Rica, and India also fall into this category. Costa Rica is implementing a plan to give every high school student an email address. Japan, Korea, and China are all coming on strong after falling behind early. Soon, Singapore won't be the only country in the world that holds an annual Miss Internet pageant. A caption in USA Today, January 19, 1999. Beneath a picture of a young Singaporean woman being crowned Miss Internet, reported, Singapore is so serious about the digital age that it has a Miss Internet contest. Stella Tan, seated, won in August. Categories in the competition include businessware and web design. From Burt Parks to Bill Gates, waist width is out, bandwidth is in. But here's the big question. What comes next after PCs per household and networks per capita as the key metric of economic power? The answer to that is twofold. Physically, what comes next is the Evernet, a world in which we will all be able to be online all the time through some information appliance, be it your television, PC, pager, faxer, toaster, or emailer. Anything that runs on electricity is now being fitted with software and linked to networks that run through your home or office. The more the internet breaks free from your desktop computer and becomes accessible from all sorts of information appliances, the closer the Evernet comes. How you choose to surf it, through your watch, cell phone, or PC, will be your business. As more and more countries go down this road, countries will increasingly be measured by how close they are to universal connectivity. They will be measured by how close they are to having all their people online, or able to get online, all the time, everywhere they go, and by how rich a variety of services they can offer on this Evernet. For instance, how many of your households will have speech-to-text transcription services through the Evernet so people can just dictate anything to anyone on their home computers? How good will the video conferencing services offered by your Evernet be so that people can transmit images and talk face-to-face through the Evernet at virtually no cost? How many of your educational institutions will be offering courses online, so people can study and learn whenever they want from wherever they want? How well encrypted will your Evernet be so that data can be stored safely and all credit card commerce can be conducted without worry of cyber theft? How convenient and multidimensional will be the information appliances that your people carry around with them at all times so that they can always be online? Is your company or country a shaper or an adapter. But while having your companies and population linked to the Evernet will be a necessary component of economic power, it will not be sufficient. It's only going to be half the power story. The other half will be about how well and how creatively your country or companies learn to exploit this Evernet. Power will flow not simply to those who are the most wired, but to those who are the most creative at bringing together firms, governments, capital, information, consumers, and talent in networked coalitions that create value. Some will be corporate-led coalitions to create commercial value. Some will be government-led coalitions to create geopolitical value. And some will be activist-led coalitions to create or preserve human values, such as worker rights, human rights, or environmental preservation. In this system, companies, governments, or activists will either be what John Hagel III of McKinsey originally called shapers or adapters. The shapers are those companies, countries, or activists who define the rules and interactions that will govern a certain activity in this Evernet world. Whether that activity is making a profit, making a war, or making a government or corporation respect human rights. The adapters are those companies who adapt themselves to the rules and interaction frameworks shaped by others, and learn to profit from them by carving out their own niches. The more consumers, companies, and countries are all connected into a single Evernet, the more power will accrue to the great shapers. Already, you can see all over the world struggles emerging over which country or company or consumer activist group or super-empowered individual is going to be the shaper of various rules or standards, because once you shape a new standard in such a wired world, in such a world without walls, its reach can be enormous. It can influence the behavior or buying habits of a huge number of people from one end of the globe to the other. A good example of a shaper in the economic realm is eBay, the online auction site. It came out of nowhere, and within 3 years created a new set of rules and forms of interaction by which consumers would buy and sell things on the World Wide Web. eBay brought together buyers and sellers on the Internet to create a whole new marketplace for doing this, outside conventional newspaper classified ads or other traditional barter centers, and also to create its own set of rules. Each person selling things on eBay is rated by people who do business with him or her, and if you cheat people, even once, your eBay rating will be affected in a way that could make it impossible for you to do business in the future, because everyone on the World Wide Web can find out that you have been rated a cheater. Once a standard such as eBay's emerges, the competition then moves to other areas or to see who can adapt eBay's innovation the best. So now you don't just have individuals quaintly buying and selling and trading goods through eBay, but you have people who have set up whole companies to do so. You want a lot of people adapting to your standard and profiting from it, because that stabilizes it and locks it in. It also creates a lot of innovation around your standard that is bound to improve it. The emergence of the Evernet is making it possible for people to develop eBay-like exchanges in a variety of industries, from home building to construction to the selling of steel or plastics. These exchanges bring buyers and sellers together in a particular industry in a way that is allowing much more efficient trading, selling, and bartering of goods on a global scale, as well as a sharing or selling of expertise. If your company or country can become the shaper of one or more of these exchanges, e-steel, e-rubber, e-cement, in the great Evernet land grab that is now underway, it will be a real source of power, because the reach of these exchanges will be global, and once one gets established, such as eBay, it is difficult to knock off. There will be one or two in every industry, and that's it. Microsoft is another shaper. it has brought customers and companies together into a value net based around its technologies, standards, software, and operating systems. To be an effective shaper, you have to be able to attract a lot of adapters. But the key to having a lot of adapters to your standard is that it be able to create a lot of value for other people too, whether it is a product, a human value, or a set of geopolitical rules. If people become reluctant members of your value network, eventually they will rebel against it by seeking a different standard. So one thing a shaper always has to be aware of is whether he is leaving room in his value chain, some food on the table, so that others will have an incentive to adapt to his standards. Or is he trying to gobble up every crumb of profit potentially created by his standard? If eBay not only shaped a whole new marketplace for doing business, but also tried to run all the most profitable exchanges under its umbrella, fewer and fewer people would have an incentive to adapt to the eBay system, and eventually it would collapse. Microsoft's greed and its reluctance to make room for others, such as Netscape, to adapt its operating system for easy browsing of the Internet, ultimately led to the Justice Department's antitrust suit against Microsoft, as well as provoking others to try to shape a different Internet standard from Microsoft's. The key to being an effective shaper is not to be a pig, which Microsoft was. Not all successful shapers start out as shapers. Dell, for instance, started out as an adapter. It took an existing technology, the IBM PC, and brilliantly adapted it through creative manufacturing techniques. Dell became part of IBM's value chain. Then Dell, in turn, became a shaper. In its effort to become the best adapter of the IBM PC, Dell shaped innovative new ways to use the Internet to reach customers and manage suppliers and inventories. In doing so, it created its own value chain, and IBM turned around and became an adapter of Dell's Internet-based manufacturing and inventory techniques. The same principle applies in geopolitics. The United States today is the world's great geopolitical shaper. While it would be too much to say that the United States is in charge of globalization, it is the country with the greatest ability, for the moment, to shape the coalitions that can manage globalization geopolitically. For instance, in this more connected world, the United States defined how capital, information, and military might were to be brought to bear to rescue the Kosovar Albanians evicted by Yugoslavia in 1999. It was the United States that shaped many of the key rules by which the World Trade Organization would operate and the terms under which China would be admitted. It was the United States that shaped the United Nations' response to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. The other NATO countries, the Chinese and the Russians, were usually adapters, sometimes reluctant adapters. The United States and Great Britain were the key shapers of the golden straitjacket, along with the supermarkets. In this interconnected world, the rules of the golden straitjacket have become the widely adopted standard for creating growth. The golden straitjacket has also created a global value chain for how business and trade are conducted, from which countries such as the United States and Great Britain greatly benefit. But there are now a lot of countries who see benefit in adapting to it and coming up with their own variations, thus reinforcing the influence of the golden straitjacket. As in the business world, the key to being a successful geopolitical shaper is being generous and not too overbearing, so other countries see benefit to themselves or to the stability of the region around them from adapting to your standard and geopolitical rules. America would be a greedy shaper if it were to say to the rest of the world, "You must adopt the golden straitjacket and open your country to free trade, but as you do, we're going to export everything we can to your country, and we're only going to let you export a few things to America." That wouldn't give countries much incentive to put on the golden straitjacket, and would give them instead a great incentive to write their own new standard. The geopolitical shapers who don't last long are those who try to capture too much for themselves and don't leave anything on the table for others to have an incentive to adapt and create around. What is least understood, and in many ways most interesting, is how the same principle of shapers and adapters can be applied when thinking about human rights, social activism, charity, and environmentalism. All sorts of private groups, governments, super-empowered individuals, and companies can now become shapers of rules and coalitions to produce better governance in all these areas, much more than ever before. But many activists don't understand this opportunity for social entrepreneurship. Here's how to think about this. When America, beginning in the late 19th century, moved from a collection of semi-autonomous regional economies to a more integrated national economy, it really gave birth to the federal government as we know it today. The Federal Reserve, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, and other such institutions all came out of this era. A national economy needed a set of national institutions that could cover it, monitor it, and regulate it. The natural tendency is to assume that the same will or should happen with globalization. That is, as we move from a collection of semi-autonomous national economies to a more integrated global economy, we will develop a kind of global government to cover it, monitor it, and regulate it. But making the leap from regional institutions to national institutions within countries is much easier than making the leap from national institutions within each country to global institutions that will oversee every country. You bump into two problems when you go global. One is sovereignty, the sheer reluctance of people to be ruled by politicians and bureaucrats from the other side of the world, over whom they have no democratic or other control. And the other is the very nature of the globalization system itself. In a world without walls, increasingly built around an evernet, the ability of any global governing institution to actually get its arms around a problem and enforce certain taxes or behaviors is limited. Whether it is Interpol trying to track criminal financial transfers over the internet from the Cayman Islands to the Channel Islands, or the World Trade Organization trying to figure out how to regulate trade in cyberspace, every day there are more and more places that traditional government institutions find it hard to reach into. Therefore, when it comes to enforcing global norms for the environment, human rights, financial interactions, or worker conditions, the shaper is not going to be a global government, at least anytime soon. But what then do we do? We can't ignore these problems, and we don't want to just leave them to the marketplace to solve. So now we come to the key question. How do we get better global governance in areas such as environment, human rights, financial interactions, and worker conditions without having global government? How do we manage and regulate issues that we really value as human beings and communities, but without some global COP to do it for us? The answer is to understand that in a world of networks, individuals, companies, communities, consumers, activist groups, and governments all have the power to be shapers, to shape human value chains. And when you are the shaper of a coalition in support of a certain human value, you would be amazed what you can do without global government to create better global governance. It requires a radical new way of thinking about how to mobilize power, though. It requires thinking about how one can exploit the internet, the power of consumers, and the exposure of multinational companies who need to do business all over the world, and therefore need to protect their brand names all over the world. Let me give a few examples. One of the biggest questions to arise in the age of globalization is how we deal with the important issue of workers' rights and sweatshops in the developing world. In this post-communist era, while many human rights activists are still focused on promoting issues of free speech, elections, and the right to write an op-ed piece, people in the developing world are increasingly focused on workers' rights, jobs, the right to organize, and the right to decent working conditions. Quite simply, for many workers around the world, oppression by the unchecked commissars has been replaced with oppression by the unregulated capitalists who move their manufacturing from country to country constantly in search of those who will work for the lowest wages and lowest standards. To some, the Nike swoosh is now as scary as the hammer and sickle. These workers need practical help, but there is no global government to turn to that can legislate better working conditions for all. For years, U.S. manufacturers have used their clout in Congress to block any attempt to impose U.S. working standards on their factories abroad. Meanwhile, when these shirt makers from South Carolina shift production to Guatemala, there are no local standards that are enforced there, and the International Labor Organization has no clout. So you end up with neither local nor global enforcement, which was highlighted in 1996 with the exposure of the appalling working conditions in a Honduran factory producing Kathy Lee Gifford brand clothing. Therefore, to wait for global government to fix the problem is to wait forever. In the face of such a challenge, the human rights community needs to retool in this post-Cold War world, every bit as much as the old arms makers have had to learn how to make subway cars and toasters instead of tanks. In the Cold War, argued Michael Posner, head of the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, the main issue was how do you hold governments accountable when they violate laws and norms? Today, the emerging issue is how do you hold private companies accountable for the treatment of their workers at a time when government control is ebbing all over the world, or governments themselves, such as in China, are going into business and can't be expected to play the watchdog or protection role. In such a world, activists have to learn how to use globalization to their advantage. They have to learn how to compel companies to behave better by mobilizing global consumers through the Internet. I call this the Network Solution for Human Rights, and it's the future of social advocacy. It is bottom-up regulation, or side-by-side regulation, not top-down regulation. You empower the bottom instead of waiting for the top by shaping a coalition that produces better governance without global government. Precisely such an experiment was initiated in late 1999. Out of the Kathy Lee Gifford controversy, a new coalition was born called the Fair Labor Association. It brought together the U.S. government, workers' rights activists such as the Lawyers Committee, apparel makers, and American college students. It works like this. Most of the major global apparel companies and human rights groups agreed on a minimum standard for working conditions in their factories, including restrictions on child labor and working hours. They also agreed on a uniform system of monitoring, whereby independent external monitors are being allowed to make surprise visits to factories. The monitors are accredited by the FLA and range from church groups to PricewaterhouseCoopers. The FLA issues annual reports on each company's compliance, which are broadcast on the Internet and eventually should be published by Consumer Reports. If a company meets the standards, it is allowed to attach a special FLA label on its clothes, so consumers have credible information to differentiate among brands, that is, to buy those that support worker rights and shun those that don't. More than 100 universities joined the coalition and have insisted that their bookstores, which sell huge numbers of sneakers, T-shirts, and sweatshirts, sell only FLA-labeled products. The hope is that eventually all major retailers will do so as well. This program is not going to revolutionize working conditions overnight, but it's a start at shaping a new set of norms and rules for the global garment industry. And it is being done without global government, but instead by putting together a coalition that has the potential to make every consumer a human rights enforcer and to deprive global corporations of anywhere to hide. It's amazing how caught up some activists are in the old world, said Paul Gilding, the former head of Greenpeace, who now advises multinationals on sustainable development. The old model is you go into the streets, raise the outrage of the community, get the government to pass a law, the companies resist, eventually a compromise is reached, and in 5 years, things change. We don't have time for that anymore. The groups making the biggest difference today are those that harness the economic self-interest of companies and consumers and make that a force for environmental protection, for upgrading workers' rights, for promoting human rights, rather than a force working against such values. That means working with multinationals and consumers and basically showing the companies how they can be both green and profitable at the same time, and making clear to them that if they don't upgrade their environmental practices or their labor standards abroad, the activist community will mount a campaign against them through the internet with consumers all over the world. Economic self-interest is the big force at work in the world. It isn't the only one. Laws and norms still matter. Government still matters. Government still needs to pass laws and regulate in ways that protect society as a whole, and not just the interests of one particular group of consumers or activists. But often the best way to win adherence to laws and norms is by trying to channel economic self-interest, the very metabolism of the globalization system, in a way that makes it restorative rather than destructive. In the early 1990s, the World Trade Organization ruled that American laws banning tuna caught in nets that also catch dolphins were a trade barrier. This understandably upset many environmentalists. Some chose to attack the WTO, particularly at its meeting in Seattle in late 1999. But others decided to get organized and become shapers of the value they wanted to uphold, that fishermen shouldn't kill dolphins simply to catch tuna on the cheap. As a result of their actions, it has become virtually impossible to buy a can of tuna in any American grocery store that isn't labeled dolphin safe. But how could that be if the WTO said our law was a trade barrier? Because the smart activists just went around the WTO ruling and sought to shape new behavior in another way. They mobilized consumers and the internet to pressure the tuna companies into going dolphin safe. The tuna companies pressured the fishermen into using dolphin safe nets because they didn't want to lose their customers. And as a result, many dolphins got saved. The dolphin safe standard is still not perfect. Some fishermen still cheat, and companies look the other way. But it's a vast improvement on the free-for-all that existed before. And that improvement is the result of environmental activists shaping a new standard by using a network solution with no real government involvement. Our decision to go dolphin safe was purely based on consumer feedback, Michael Mullen, spokesman for Starkist Tuna, told me. We probably get about 1,000 calls and 300 consumer emails a week. In Chapter 13, Demolition Man, I will explore in greater detail how this approach is being applied in the environmental arena by organizations such as Conservation International to help save everything from the Brazilian rainforest to the world's biggest wetland. Consider one more example of this strategy from a whole different area, the war on poverty. Let me introduce the website, www.planetfinance.org. It is the brainchild of French banker Jacques Attali, who decided that globalization empowered him to become a shaper of strategies for combating global poverty, without waiting for some global government to do it. Planet Finance works like this. Roughly 1.3 billion people live on a dollar a day. One thing we know is that one of the most effective tools for combating their poverty is micro-lending. Micro-loans range from $100 to $1,000. They go mostly to women and are given without any collateral. Micro-loan recipients use them to buy everything from sewing machines to bicycles to get their vegetables to market to beauty supplies to start a salon in a Bangladesh slum. These people have the will to better themselves, they just don't have the basic cash, and that's what microloans provide. While people who need microloans are not online, many of the microbanks and aid organizations that work with the poor do have phones and computers and can get online. What Planet Finance is doing is wiring these 7,000 microfinance groups around the world into a network that holds huge possibilities. First, explained Mr. Atali, Planet is connecting as many microbanks as possible so they can share solutions. Second, we are helping those that are not online get online, as we did in Benin. Third, we are creating a system, like Moody's, that is rating microbanks according to their ethics, how well they serve the poor, and financial efficiency. Fourth, we are setting up a university online to teach best practices to microbanks and an online marketplace for microloan recipients to sell their crafts. Finally, we are creating Planet Bank, which is extending lines of credit to microbanks and will enable anyone to come to our website, donate money to selected projects offered by the best microbanks, and then track who that money went to and how it is used. Once Planet can rate and link all the microbanks through the Internet, it can help them lower their biggest cost, tracking and processing all these little loans. The hope is that a single microbanker, armed with the sort of information device that FedEx uses to track your packages, could keep track of hundreds of loans and interest payments at a time. If the processing and transaction costs of these microloans can be reduced, they can be bundled together and sold on a commercial basis to the Citibanks of the world. Microbanks usually charge 4 to 5% interest a month in order to cover costs and get people to pay them back quickly so that the money can be recycled to someone else. So this market, with those sorts of interest rates, would appeal to big banks if the processing costs were cut. And that would change everything, because right now there is great demand for microloans, but the money pool for them is limited to donations by individuals and governments. By contrast, with $20 billion in commercial loans from big banks, you could provide microloans to 100 million people living on a dollar a day. That's how you change the world, by using globalization against itself, by becoming a shaper who doesn't just wait around for global government to alleviate poverty, but instead uses the new system to mobilize the big, cold, selfish market players to do the right thing for the wrong reason. Greed. By getting the big banks to become adapters of the new concept shaped by Planet Finance and giving them an economic incentive to do so, a whole new set of possibilities for combating poverty are opened up. There's an old saying, feed a man a fish and you've fed him for a day. Teach a man to fish and you've fed him for a lifetime, said Mr. Atali. Well, we have millions of poor people who know how to fish. They just don't have a pole. Through Planet, we might be able to get poles for a lot more of them. In a wired world without walls, the future belongs to the shapers and adapters, and they can be companies or consumers, superpowers, or super-empowered individuals. Chapter 11. Buy Taiwan, hold Italy, sell France. While getting wired and learning to become a shaper or adapter are going to be critical in determining a country's or company's clout in the Internet age, other factors will also be important. factors that will determine just how good a shaper or adapter you will be. This chapter explores what those factors are and why countries or companies that have them are ones you would want to buy or hold, and why countries that don't have them are ones you would want to sell. I call this checklist the 9 Habits of Highly Effective Countries. In the Cold War system, regions tended to develop together. Western European countries developed at their own pace, Latin America at its own pace, the East Asian tigers at their own pace, Eastern Europe at its own pace, and Africa at its own pace. The big differences tended to be among regions. East Asia made it. Latin America walked ahead. The Middle East stagnated, except for the windfall profits of oil, and Africa fell through the floor. Egypt and South Korea started at the same level of per capita income back in the 1950s, but by the 1990s, there was a huge gap between them. What we are going to see in the globalization system is a continuation of this trend, only now the differentiation is going to be increasingly within regions and within countries of the same region, as some choose prosperity, get wired, become shapers, and adopt the habits of effective countries, and others do not. For instance, you will see a gap emerge in the Middle East between Tunisia, which in the 1990s put on the golden straitjacket, signed a free trade agreement with the European Union, and adopted many of the habits of effective countries, and some of its Arab neighbors, which have not. And you will see hot zones emerge within countries, such as coastal China around Shanghai, or Bangalore in India, where incomes and lifestyles will far outstrip other regions right next door in the same country. So much so that it will feel like they are in a different country. The gaps between developed countries and within developing countries may become politically the most sensitive for world politics. Who is in the fast world within a particular region or country will be much more important than whether that country was in the first world or third world during the Cold War. As I noted in the previous chapter, the best countries and companies will mirror one another's habits. So, after asking the 2 most basic questions, how wired is your country or company, and is it a shaper or adapter, here are the other 9 questions I ask to measure its economic power and potential. How fast is your country or company? Klaus Schwab of the Davos World Economic Forum once observed, "We have moved from a world where the big eat the small to a world where the fast eat the slow." And he is right. Because of the 3 democratizations, the barriers to entry into virtually any business today have been dramatically lowered. And this means that the speed by which a product goes from being an innovation to being a commodity has become turbocharged. If your company or country, for social, cultural, or political reasons, is not willing to let Schumpeter's creative destruction work as fast as today's turbo markets, it will fall behind. It is not for nothing that Bill Gates likes to say that at Microsoft they know only one thing. In 4 years, every product they make will be obsolete. The only question is whether Microsoft will make it obsolete or one of its competitors will. If Microsoft makes it obsolete, the company will thrive. If one of its competitors makes it obsolete, Microsoft will be in trouble. Bill Gates almost made Microsoft obsolete by initially concluding that the Internet was not the future of computing. Lucky for him, he came around before his 4 years were up. No one has to explain this speed issue to the senior managers of Compaq Computer. They thrived by it, and they died by it. Compaq got its start by being quicker than IBM at creative destruction. It almost creatively destroyed IBM in the process. What happened was that in 1985, Intel developed a new 386 microprocessor. Survived by it, and they died by it. Compaq got its start by being quicker than IBM at creative destruction. It almost creatively destroyed IBM in the process. What happened was that in 1985, Intel developed a new 386 microprocessor, offering roughly double the speed of its 286 chip. Compaq's whole business strategy was to become the technology leader in clock speed. That meant that every time Intel came out with a new, faster chip, not just from 286 to 386, but even within each chip model, when it increased the speed by even 5 megahertz, Compaq wanted to be the first to market with that faster chip in its desktops and laptops. In the 1980s, when a new personal computer was launched, it would be phased in first the United States and a few months later in Europe, and eventually it could hit India and the Middle East. It was assumed that the European and Asian markets were somehow shielded from what was happening in America. Compaq was the first to understand that this was not the case, that a new product had to be released at absolutely the same moment across the world. And therefore, if Intel announced a new chip and people read about it in their newspaper or on the internet, they expected to find it installed in the PC or laptop they went out to buy the next day. That day, you want to be on the dealer's shelf, said Enrico Pessatori, Compaq Senior Vice President for Corporate Marketing. And if you are just 2 weeks late, you are considered to be slow. You are rated by the analysts as a slow company. You will be seen as not capturing the early gross margin, which comes from being the first to market. As such, Compaq perfected a very fast development cycle for installing new chips. The company had an intimate relationship with Intel, so that Compaq's engineers were able to incorporate the latest new chip into their designs with the minimal modifications to their basic computer box, and then get that basic PC box and its faster chip out the door before any of the other large manufacturers. Compaq was able to stay at the cutting edge because for as long as possible, it kept most everything else about its basic PC models the same, except the speed of the microprocessor chip and the programming needed to run it. As a result, Compaq was constantly driving down the cost of its basic PC box and its components by using the same design over and over again, and just installing the latest, fastest microprocessor. Rule: the longer any product is on the market, the cheaper its components become. And since the microprocessor speed was driving the market price of computers, Compaq was able to quickly grow its profit margins, making cheaper and cheaper boxes for which they could charge more and more because they always had the fastest new chip. And then doing it all quicker and quicker. These rising profits also gave Compaq the ability to discount, and therefore to eat into IBM's lunch coming and going. IBM, by contrast, wanted to take its time. It always preferred to introduce any new leap in technology all at once, with a whole new computer model. That's why when Intel came out with a 386 chip and invited IBM to run with it, IBM didn't want to introduce that faster chip into its already existing model, the IBM AT, which stood for Advanced Technology, and was based on the 286 chip. IBM basically wanted to wait until it sold all its ATs so that it could introduce the 386 into a whole new PC system, the PS2. Why not? IBM was the biggest, baddest company on the block, and in a world of walls, IBM figured it had plenty of time to do things its way. IBM, under its chairman at the time, John Akers, was incredibly arrogant and really did resemble the Soviet Union in many ways. The whole company was set up to meet the revenue and profit numbers dictated by the chairman's plan. So internally, the whole company got focused not on what the market was demanding by way of products, in this case, incrementally faster computers as soon as the new technology was available, but rather on what the Politburo of IBM wanted by way of profit numbers in order to grow the company at a certain rate. What IBM didn't understand at that time was that the barriers to entry into its business were falling, and that the key to success was an ability to limit your product line, keeping as many components and factors of design constant for as long as possible in order to ride down the cost curve and focus on what the public really wanted, which was a computer that didn't take all morning to boot up. But IBM was still caught up in its old culture. Its primary business up until the 1970s was leasing large mainframe computer systems to companies. And if IBM could come up with a whole new large system every couple of years, it would just install it for all those customers and charge them more. But the PC was a whole different animal. Customers didn't want to have to adopt a whole new system every couple of years. They just wanted it faster. Compaq, listening to its customers, understood that, and got fast. IBM, listening to itself, didn't, and stayed slow. IBM was working on an old business model. It did not understand that for this new category, completely different rules applied. Eckhard Pfeiffer, Compaq's president from 1991 until early 1999, told me. So Intel came out with the 386 chip, and they said to IBM, go with it. And IBM said, no. So Intel came to Compaq, and we said, we'll do it. We struck the deal with Intel. Game over, at least for a while. Compaq took a huge bite out of IBM's PC business. I'd say 10 to 15 years ago, it was not critical not to be on the starting line when Intel put their next microprocessor out, added Pfeiffer. Because people didn't have that sense of urgency, they said, fine, I'll wait a month or two. Maybe that will get me a few more bucks out of the system I'm selling. But today, it's an absolute must to be ready to take that next microprocessor and run with it from day one. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, Compaq could design products faster than its competitors. So it could provide solutions for its customers faster than its competitors, so it could collect profits faster than its competitors. Earl Mason, Compaq's then chief financial officer, told me in 1998, if you can continuously reduce the time from when you pay a dollar out to a supplier to the time when you collect a dollar in from a customer, your total asset turns will start to accelerate to a point where you are able to draw in tremendous amounts of cash. From the end of 1985 to the first quarter of 1998, our cash-to-cash acceleration has allowed us to grow our cash account from $900 million to $7 billion. If you're successful at being fast, by definition, you'll get big. But if you're just big and not fast, you're going down. Alas, that is eventually what happened to Compaq less than a year after I interviewed Mason. Compaq reached a point where it got bigger without getting faster, because it missed the next revolution. By failing to understand the full meaning of the Internet and evolve its marketing and manufacturing model accordingly, Compaq fell behind its main competitor, Dell. Dell pioneered the use of telephone sales to tie marketing to manufacturing and make every PC box a custom-built box that each caller to Dell could design to his or her specifications. By selling directly to customers and avoiding the dealers and their markups, Dell was always able to give customers a little bit more speed and power for their money. Then, when the Internet came along, Dell was the first to absorb it and integrate it into every aspect of its business. The Internet gave Dell even more control over its inventory, so in effect, it didn't have to build a computer until it was ordered. Suppliers were connected via the Internet, so they could see just when a customer was ordering a computer, and therefore, parts didn't have to come from the suppliers until they were needed. Dell could synchronize raw materials coming into its factories from all over the world and operate with just 6 days of inventory on hand, which saved it huge amounts of money. This made it easier to do even more customization for consumers, and to do it faster and cheaper. Dell didn't just use the Internet. It made it the backbone of how it related to itself, customers, and suppliers. And in doing so, it got very, very fast. Compaq, by contrast, stuck too long with its more traditional manufacturing model and in-store and dealer sales channel, ignoring the role of the Internet. So Dell did to Compaq with the Internet what Compaq did to IBM by installing faster chips faster. And it all happened so fast. Boy, do I know. I was writing the first edition of this book at the time. I had gone down to Houston to interview the Compaq leadership in August 1998. On the wall of the management suite at Compaq was the Forbes magazine cover story naming Compaq the best managed company in America in 1997. A month later, I was at a conference at Stanford and ran into John Chambers from Cisco. He asked me what I was doing, and I mentioned to him that I was using Compaq as an example of a fast company for this chapter of my book. "Big mistake," said Chambers. "You should be using Dell." My heart sank, but it was too late. I was already locked into Compaq. I had just interviewed its whole leadership. But Chambers, because his company makes the black boxes that connect firms to the Internet, knew the difference between Dell and Compaq long before the market did. He could see that Compaq was falling behind. And in a fast world, it wouldn't be long before the gap would be there for all to see. Well, the first edition of this book was published on April 21, 1999. The week before the book hit the stores, Compaq's top leaders, including Pfeiffer and Mason, were ousted by the company's board after that year's first quarter profits were half of what analysts had expected. As the Compaq case illustrates, the Internet is creating a whole new level of speed, which has come to be known as net speed. No one can tell you how fast net speed actually is, but what they can tell you is that the Internet, as it moves into business, is forcing every company to speed up everything it does, from design to production to marketing. The word from the Silicon Frontier is that you can kiss your 5-year plan goodbye, or for that matter, any plan that ends in year, reported Business Week, November 1, 1999. And that goes for the Rust Belt, too. Some companies are writing and rewriting strategy every quarter, or even every week, or else. Net speeds force all sorts of cultural changes. Hierarchies flatten out. Budget cycles get compressed, decision-making gets pushed out to the front lines, and customer expectations, not the executive board, guide the next big project. What's driving all this? Certainly web economics is a factor. As costs plummet for new entrants in business, such as retailing or finance, new competition springs up faster and forces everybody to counterpunch constantly. But a bigger factor is how the net puts companies in closer touch with customers, both through direct sales and by soliciting regular feedback. Strategic planning used to be based on a build-then-sell model, says John M. Jordan, director of e-commerce research at Ernst & Young. Now, he says, that's out the window. Customers are calling the shots, telling companies what they want, and companies have to respond to those desires or lose out. It's a whole new way of thinking about strategy. Countries need to take heed of such sagas. So when I come into a country now, one of the first questions I ask is, how quickly does your government and society evaluate, innovate, decision-make, deregulate, and adapt? That is, to what extent have you restructured your economy to increase the speed of government approvals, transactions, investment, and production? How fast can one of your citizens move an idea from his garage to the market? How quickly can you raise capital for a crazy idea, and how quickly can you come up with new ideas? And how quick are you at destroying, through bankruptcy, inefficient firms? Some countries or regions are fast at capitalist creation because their governments have learned how to speed things up. Before, nobody was really producing in Scotland, said Enrico Pesatori, Compaq's senior vice president for corporate marketing. Now you can't afford not to be there. Why? Because they have constructed an infrastructure. If you go to Scotland, everything is ready. The regulatory system, the tax environment, the transportation, the telecommunications, for you to set up your manufacturing facility as fast as you can. And some countries are fast because their people, for reasons of culture, history, or sheer DNA, are naturally agile, and they have gotten even faster as their governments have provided them with the basics and then just gotten out of the way. Regions such as Northern Italy, Tel Aviv, Shanghai, South Korea, Beirut, and Bangalore are naturally fast and are taking off these days, separating themselves from other parts of their own countries. These regions are the hot zones, and they will be incredible engines of growth for their countries. When you take one of these hot zones, equip it with the internet, and connect it with a diaspora community spread out all over the world, such as overseas Chinese, Jews, Italians, Lebanese, Indians, or Koreans, you have what I like to call a cyber tribe. These cyber tribes combine speed, creativity, entrepreneurial talent, and global networking in ways that can generate enormous wealth. In fact, Northern Italy today is the richest region of Europe. Reginald Bartholomew, a former American ambassador to Italy, explained why, saying, "Let's say you come to France, Germany, and Italy and tell them, 'I want to buy some purple cheese.' What happens? Well, the French will tell you, 'Monsieur, cheese is never purple.' The Germans will tell you, 'Purple cheese is not in the catalog this year.' But the Italians, the Italians will say to you, 'What shade of purple would you like? Magenta?' If Northern Italy were a stock, I'd hold it." Is your country or company harvesting its knowledge? We have moved from a world where the key to wealth is how you seize, hold, and exploit territory, to a world in which the key to wealth is how your country or company amasses, shares, and harvests knowledge. As former Citibank chairman Walter Wriston observed in an essay in Foreign Affairs, September 1997, "The pursuit of wealth is now largely the pursuit of information and its application to the means of production. The rules, customs, skills, and talents necessary to uncover, capture, produce, preserve, and exploit information are now humankind's most important assets. The competition for the best information has replaced the competition for the best farmland or coal fields. In fact, the appetite to annex territory has already attenuated, and major powers have withdrawn from previously occupied territories. In the past, when the method of creating wealth changed, old power structures lost influence. New ones arose, and every facet of society was affected. As we can already see the beginning of that process in this revolution, one can postulate that in the next few decades, the attraction and management of intellectual capital will determine which institutions and nations will survive and prosper, and which will not. How wired is your country is a measure of how broad and deep are its networks. Is your country harvesting its knowledge is a measure of how well a country and its companies are using those networks. Being wired is necessary, but not sufficient. A country also needs to amass knowledge effectively and deploy it effectively. It needs to be more wired than ever and more educated than ever. That is why I like to look at two tables when I come to a country. One is the table that Hewlett-Packard puts together, showing which countries in the world today are the most wired. The other is the annual OECD table that lists which of the 29 richest countries in the world are producing the highest percentages of high school graduates and spending the highest percentages of their national income on teacher salaries. If you see which countries top both lists, megabits per capita and high school grads per capita, you will have a good indication of who is on the right track and who is not. It is no accident, for instance, that Finland, which now has one of the world's highest standards of living, sits near the top of both lists. The same is true for companies. German electronics giant Siemens is a very wired company, but it has a reputation for being weak at tapping its own knowledge. I once heard a management consultant who worked with Siemens remark, "If Siemens only knew what Siemens knows, it would be a rich company." The same is true of countries. If France only knew what France knows, if China only knew what China knows. The companies and countries that learn to use their networks most efficiently are those that will thrive. At General Electric, the notion of sharing ideas has been so deeply embedded into the company's culture that pay and promotions are based, in part, on an executive's boundaryless behavior, his or her ability and willingness to synthesize ideas, cross-fertilize the company, and bring disparate knowledge threads together to produce value-added products. You can understand this principle best when you apply it to a company that you normally would not associate with being in the knowledge business. Say, for instance, the Chevron Oil Company. I was in Kuwait in 1997, talking with H.F. Iskander, the general manager of Chevron's Kuwait office, and one of the sharpest oil men in the Gulf. We were chatting about how Chevron was trying to get back into oil exploration in Kuwait. As Iskander was ticking off Chevron's strong points and why they should be attractive to Kuwait, he mentioned in passing that Chevron is not an oil company, it's a learning company. "What do you mean, a learning company?" I asked. "Oil companies are drilling companies. They're guys in hard hats with their hands and faces smeared with crude oil. What's this learning company stuff?" Iskander explained. In the 1970s, virtually all the oil-exporting countries in the Middle East kicked out the major multinational oil companies in order to pump their own oil. It was partly an economic decision and partly a political decision, reflecting the broad assertion of independence by post-colonial countries during the Cold War. But 20 years later, many of those oil-exporting countries are now reconsidering what they did and are looking to invite the multinational oil companies back in. In part, it's because as oil reserves diminish and they need to start looking for more hard-to-find reserves, oil exploration becomes more expensive and requires more capital. But in part, it's because as oil reserves diminish and they need to start looking for those hard-to-find reserves, oil exploration requires more knowledge. Chevron is pumping oil in different locations all over the world, explained Iskander. There is no problem we have not confronted and solved somewhere. There isn't a rock we haven't drilled through. We centralize all that knowledge at our headquarters, analyze it, sort it out, and that enables us to solve any oil drilling problem anywhere. As a developing country, you may have a national oil company that has been pumping your own oil for 20 years. But we tell them, look, you have 20 years of experience, but there's no diversity. It is just 1 year of knowledge 20 times over. When you are operating in a multitude of countries like Chevron, you see a multitude of different problems, and you have to come up with a multitude of solutions. You have to, or you won't be in business. All those solutions are then stored in Chevron's corporate memory. The key to our business now is to tap that memory and bring out the solution that we use to solve a problem in Nigeria in order to solve the same problem in China or Kuwait. In the old days, it might have taken us 2 years to find the person in the company who actually found that Nigeria solution and get him to China, where he could apply it. Now, with email and the globalization of our workforce, where people move around the world to different assignments much more frequently, we can get that solution out of Chevron's memory very quickly. This is why companies today protect their internal knowledge networks the way ancient kingdoms used to build walls and moats around their territory and farm fields. I went to visit Sun Microsystems at their headquarters outside Palo Alto. Before I could get inside to see the executive I was scheduled to interview, the receptionist handed me a one-page legal form to sign entitled Confidential Non-Disclosure Agreement. At the top of the form, there were two boxes to check, confidential visit or unclassified visit. Among the things I had to agree to on this document before I could enter Sun's offices was that the signatory agrees not to disclose the proprietary information to any third party. Signatory agrees to use the proprietary information only for purposes expressly authorized in writing by Sun, and not to use it for signatory's own use. You can get into the CIA today with less paperwork. This is also why all major companies now, and many minor ones, have added the job of CIO, Chief Information Officer. Companies have found that there is a material benefit and much improved effectiveness for making sure they are using their knowledge and information well at every stage of production and development. How long will it be before every country has a Minister of Information whose job is not to tell the outside world what's going on inside that country, as it was in the Cold War, but to help that country understand what it knows and to make sure it is harvesting its own knowledge in the most efficient manner. T.J. Rogers, founder of Cypress Semiconductor, says, "The winners and losers in the information age will be differentiated by brain power. It takes 2% of Americans to feed us all, and 5% to make everything we need. Everything else will be service and information technology, and in that world, humans and brains will be the key variable." How much does your country or company weigh? We are moving from a world where the heavy eat the light to a world where the light eat the heavy. So, when I come to a country now, one of the things I ask is, how much does it weigh? Or actually, how much does an average container of its exports weigh? Alan Greenspan taught me the relevance of this question. It has to do with what economists call the substitution effect, whereby ideas, knowledge, and information technologies are increasingly substituted for bulk weight in the creation of economic value. The more knowledge and information technology, such as miniaturized microchips, are designed into a product, the less it tends to weigh. The more productive it tends to be, the more it tends to sell for, and the richer it will make your company or your country. By substituting transistors for vacuum tubes, we have made radios smaller. Hair-thin fiber optic cable has replaced heavy copper wire. Digital tape recorders now offer voice-quality recording with no tape at all, just microchips and digits. Your dad's old desktop adding machine is now a handheld calculator. Advances in architecture and engineering, as well as the development of lighter but stronger building materials, now give us the same working space, but in buildings with significantly less concrete, glass, and steel tonnage than was required in an earlier era. Your 125-pound receptionist behind a 200-pound desk has probably already been replaced by a tiny voicemail device in your phone that weighs less than a feather. Therefore, one measure of the strength, vitality, and power of a country today has to be how light is its GDP. There is less weight today in each dollar of U.S. GDP than ever before. As recently as the middle of this century, Greenspan explains, the symbols of American economic strength were still our output of such weighty products as steel, motor vehicles, and heavy-duty machinery, items for which sizable proportions of production costs reflected the value and weight of the raw materials and the manual labor required to manipulate and craft them. So ingrained was this notion of weight equals value that legend has it that when Apple Computer came out with the Apple II, the first real home computer in 1977, Apple folks actually considered adding some artificial weight to it because it was so light they feared people would not take it seriously. Since then, though, Greenspan points out, trends have focused on downsized, smaller, less palpable evidence of output. Today, a country that exports primarily raw materials, commodities, iron ore, crude oil, is going to weigh a lot. A country that specializes in information technologies and services is going to weigh a lot less and is probably providing a higher standard of living for more of its people. So it is with companies. DuPont now demands that each of its divisions provide an annual measurement called shareholder value per pound. DuPont takes every product that a division makes and tries to ensure that it is constantly creating more profit out of less materials each year for each manufactured product. The 1983 prospectus for Compaq, when the company first went public, boasted, "The Compaq portable computer is a 16-bit personal computer in a self-contained portable unit that is 20 inches wide, 8.5 inches high, and 16 inches deep. The standard configuration weighs approximately 28 pounds and is light enough to carry from office to office, home for the weekend, or on business trips." That 28-pound laptop was known at Compaq as the Luggable because the only way to get it around was by lugging it around. Its retail price for a standard configuration was $2,995. By 1999, Compaq's latest laptop, the Compaq Armada 3500, weighed only 4.4 pounds with 500 times the memory. It cost $3,299 to $4,399, depending on the configuration. Since Compaq as a whole operated in 1983 on a gross profit margin of 27.6%, and by 1997 on an almost identical margin of 27.5%, it is now making more money by learning how to pack more brain power into a product that weighs one-seventh of what it did in 1983. Compaq got richer, for a while at least, by getting lighter, by getting smarter. Does your country or company dare to be open on the outside? We've moved from a world where the closed think they can survive better than the open to a world where the open thrive far, far more than the closed. Again, look at the computer world. Those computer manufacturers that tried to compete by having their own monopoly standards have had the most trouble surviving, while those that opted to compete on the basis of the open industry hardware standard, which was pioneered by IBM with help from Intel, have thrived. The so-called IBM PC clones, Compaq, Dell, Gateway, HP, Micron, Acer, adopted the IBM established standard and then proceeded to try to kill IBM and one another by building computers that could run that open standard better, cheaper, and with more technological backup. The computer companies Data General, Commodore, Wang, Prime, and Apple all tried to have their own proprietary standards. They thought, as Nicholas Negroponte pointed out in his book Being Digital, that if they could come up with a system that was both popular and unique, they could dominate and lock out all the competition. The only one of them to thrive was Apple, and that is only because it managed to build up a network of fiercely loyal niche users rather than appealing to the broadest mainstream. In an open system, we compete with our imagination, not with a lock and key, Negroponte observed. The result is not only a larger number of successful companies, but a wider variety of choice for the consumer, and an ever more nimble commercial sector, one capable of rapid change and growth. That strategy was key to Compaq becoming both an effective adapter of IBM's technology and a shaper of its own. Earl Mason explained, Compaq's strategy was to be the leader in open standards computing because the more people who write applications and software for our hardware, the more we can grow our hardware sales, service sales, and solution sales. In the old paradigm, the thinking in the computer industry was that if I had my own operating system, if I had my own independent software vendors working just for me, then I would control this whole thing. I would be independent, not interdependent, and have something that nobody else has. It didn't work because software writers wanted to write for bigger and bigger audiences. And therefore, as a computer maker, if you adopted the open standard of the industry, you got to sell bigger and bigger audiences. Apple, when it first started, wouldn't share its standards in an open way. So the software guys said, hey, this is no fun. If I work on Apple software, I'm only going to be able to write so many applications, and I'm only going to be able to sell so many, and I'm going to be dependent on Apple for all my volume. But if I work with companies operating on the open standard, I will be interdependent with a lot of different companies, like Compaq, IBM, and Dell, and that will really allow me to grow my sales. If you can get the meat and potatoes right, learning how to adapt faster, learning how to engineer smarter, learning how to relate to customers better, learning how to manage knowledge better, learning how to control costs more effectively, and learning how to manufacture more reliably, you can always compete with anyone on any standard. Indeed, the only knowledge that you want to protect and keep secret is the techniques you develop for being a better shaper or adapter than anyone else. There are things we don't share, Mason explained. The reason we don't want you to see some things we do on the manufacturing floor is because there are things we do down there that constitute our real business edge. And if you as a competitor saw it and walked out with it, you could easily implement the same thing. One reason that the Internet has grown so far so fast is that it is an open standard. The best solutions win out quickly, and the dead are removed from the battlefield quickly. There are no funerals, relatively little time is spent by companies on securing patents, and more time is spent on just winning out in the open. Robert Shapiro, chairman of Monsanto, likes to say that there are always a few things that it pays to keep secret. But the culture you create around secrecy is a slower culture, suited to a slower world. As a company, you always end up overvaluing what you know and undervaluing what is out there in plain sight. As Shapiro puts it, I would much rather say, look, I will tell you everything I know about how this system works and still beat your brains out building it. Because the truth is, you cannot rely on monopoly information for long. In the end, what matters and what lasts is what makes you better as a competitor in a wide-open race. The way you manage and exchange information and the way you learn as a company, those are your only sustainable advantages. And so it is with countries as well. All I can say, said Mason, is that being open, the chance of you becoming a victim of what you think you know is a lot less than if you're closed. Look at Japan's banking industry. Why is it technically bankrupt? Because it's very closed. They became victims of what they thought they knew. Indeed, there is